So welcome to the awfully squashed in Web Futures panel here today. My name's Chris Hall, I'm from Intergen down in Wellington. I've got a bunch of panelists from all four corners of the globe here today. So if we go from floor, and then from your right, we have Mr. Scott Hanselman from sunny Redmond, from rainy Redmond, Washington, from Portland, Oregon. Sorry. We have Yorka Adolfi from Australia, the other crowd that lost about 52-4 to the South Africans on the weekend. We have Harry Pearson from Microsoft in Redmond. We have Jonas Folles from Norway. It rains a lot in Norway too. It's fantastic for whitewater kayaking. Chris's hot tip. We've got Nigel Parker from Microsoft here in New Zealand. And Trent Mankolo, another man from down in sunny Wellington, from Optimal Usability. So we are going to take questions from the floor. So if you want to ask a question, I encourage you to stick one of your mittens up, and one of the lovely ladies will come around and see you with a microphone. But I thought I might start kicking things off first. And I'm going to start with a quote by a man by the name of David Heinemeier from 37 Signals. And I'm going to tone it down because, you know, we've got to be a little bit careful here. And so David said, "You're not on an effing plane now, and if you are, it doesn't matter." Does it matter?
You guys understand what he's saying?
Pardon?
I want to make sure the audience understands. David Heinemeier Hansen is the creator of Rails, and he's making a response to offline browsing and things like Google Gears, and the idea that someone would want to launch their browser using something like Google Reader, install a small plugin. Google Gears installs a plugin with a tiny SQL server and allows you to browse the web offline, or specifically use a single cached web page offline, where the AJAX, rather than calling home, will call to a local SQL server. And he said, "You're not on an effing plane, so you don't need offline browsing." DHH does not think that offline browsing is a good idea.
And what do you think?
I think he's wrong.
You think he's wrong? Anyone else?
Yeah, well, you don't have to be on a plane to miss having internet. Just being in Australia and New Zealand can be a little bit
tough.
You're out.
Well, it's true, right? In the US, it's internet all over the place, wireless, fast mobile broadband, but in other parts of the world, it's not as easy as getting online, so it matters a lot, I think.
It's funny you say that, because in the United States, all we hear about is how much better the internet access is everywhere else in the world. So you came down here, and it's like, wow, that's a lot more expensive than my hotel back when I'm going someplace in the United States than it is, you know. I think you got to agree with Scott on this one. I'm not sure from a usability perspective that it's a particularly good experience, right? A standalone web page is sort of a poor substitute for a full-blown application, though certainly I've been using Google Reader for quite some time, and I'm using it with the Google Gears plugin so that I can go online, download, disconnect, and get stuff done. It isn't a really rich experience, but it's certainly a passable experience.
I think that it's not that offline browsing is a good thing or a bad thing, but that just, like you said, Google Gears is just kind of a mediocre experience. You have to keep the browser open to make sure that the cache doesn't expire. I think from a usability perspective, that's less interesting to me than what I think is the rise of what they're calling single-site browsers, or there's tools like Prism and Bubbles, and this would be for the kind of person who lives in Gmail, lives in Google Reader, lives in Dig or Facebook, and doesn't want that to be a tab in their browser, but rather wants that website to be an application. So these single-site browsers allow you to make a bookmark, and that bookmark is actually an EXE. So like I've got a gmail.exe on my desktop. I double-click on it. It loads up a tiny version of Firefox that only visits one site. It visits Gmail. It's got its own process space. Now, if you added offline browsing to that, just inside of that bubble, I think that would be really, really interesting. So the idea of websites as applications, I think,
Are users doing themselves a huge disservice by relying on web-based applications?
No.
So you'd be more than happy to...
No, that's ridiculous. My wife's computer crashed a couple of days ago, and I just had to put on Office and Firefox, and she was back, right? I mean, she uses Word, Excel, and the web. That's her entire life. It makes it much easier to not have to install anything.
And so mail?
I'm sorry?
I mean, people should be happy with web browser-based mail.
Have you used Gmail?
Yeah, I have.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, same. I moved all my stuff online, and it's been a pretty good move. As a consultant, we move around a lot between computers, client computers, my own computer, home computer. It's pretty nice to just log on, go to Gmail, and start checking your email and having it all in one place. And it's a good online experience.
I mean, I think I want to pipe in here because I actually use Windows Live Mail to access. Access my Hotmail account, and I do that offline, and I do that on multiple machines, but I always leave a copy on the server, and I always go in through, you know, a web interface whenever I'm not using my own machine as well, and I get that whole continuum of data and actually following you from a client to a desktop to the web and being able to access it through mobile devices. And it's funny because it started with email, but now I assume the same thing for photos. For video, for content, I really am in that way of my data is never far away.
See, I think that what's more interesting is not offline browsing, but what he just said, which is the idea that location transparency. It's not necessarily mesh, but it's ubiquity of that information. I've got my photos on my hard drive, and I've got a program that syncs them with Flickr. Add a photo to Flickr, it shows up on my hard drive. You know, this isn't mesh doing this work, but this is just people caring that their information's in multiple places. I'm actually halfway through writing a blog post right now to show how my wife has Google Calendar and I have Outlook, and how we share calendars between each other just using the iCal format and syndication. Again, we're doing a mesh-like synchronization, but it's just because we really want that experience. Whether I'm online or offline, I've got my wife's calendar on my system in Outlook.
So let's move to another question. Have we got any questions from the audience yet? No one wants to be the first. You guys are awfully shy.
Oh, yeah,
okay. Here we go. Here we go. No, we will mic you because we are recording it.
You just need a mic. Oh, no, mic.
Thanks.
Just a personal one for Scott. I just noticed how you were sitting. Are you really a Buddhist?
Really what?
A Buddhist? You've got your Zen whole thing going.
Sitting in a yoga... Yoga and Buddhism are different things.
But you've got your Zen computer blog.
No, I'm not a Buddhist. I'm double-jointed.
So speaking of Zen, right? So Zen and the art of touch interaction. You know, so we're seeing a lot of stuff around touch interaction. We've seen another vendor ship some interesting touch-based mobile devices recently. We're starting to see Microsoft ship through partners some interesting touch-based mobile devices. Touch is coming to the desktop PC. We see things like Surface. Touch is coming to the web. Comment a bit about what that's going to do to change the web.
I think this is kind of an interesting one. People kind of see movies like Minority Report and kind of, you know, how Tom Cruise was zipping stuff around. That actually, from a usability point of view, takes a lot of physical effort. So one of the things that we talk about in usability is respecting a user's mental load and respecting a user's physical load. So I'm really interested to see what's going to happen with some of these gestural interfaces in terms of the actual, you know, it's one thing to kind of have a mouse or be keyboard driven and make these small minor movements, but to be kind of moving around all the time actually is a bit physically draining if you're doing that all day, every day. So it'd be interesting to see the future, what's going on.
What do you think people want to do?
I think if it's intuitive, you know, the kind of having it on your iPhone and kind of doing your pinch together and that kind of stuff. And also there's a wow factor at the moment. So there's some kiosks where you can kind of be interacting with what looks like a flat plane of glass, and you're kind of flipping through, you know, high-end luxury apartments kind of on this pane of glass. There's a bit of wow factor at the moment. But, yeah, I'm not too sure. But certainly if there's a physical load, if it takes a lot of physical effort to interact with these devices, then it's going to, I think... Not be so popular.
See, I think that if it was the number one way that I interacted with my machine, I think that would be a problem. You'd become tired. But I still, after using a tablet PC and a touchscreen, find myself putting my fingers on my LCD and going, ah, damn, it doesn't work. It feels to me like everyone's got webcams. Why isn't this thing noticing my hand? And why can't I just push a window over to the other? I mean, even if I just go like that and push a window to another monitor, that would make my life better.
I also think, especially with these small devices, you were mentioning about the pinching motion on the iPhone, one of the things I think is going to really affect the design of these systems is going to be just the size and the ability, the non-transparent nature of your fingers. Right? When you look at how you're going to be able to interact with a touchscreen, especially a small touchscreen like a phone, it's really hard to get precise connection compared to like a stylus base like or a pen like with a tablet PC because you can't see through your finger, right? So you end up having to build these very big blocky things that you can push that are there primarily so that you can see around your fingers. And I think that makes for a very sort of a little clunky interface in some ways. But in the end, I think it's not going to have that much of a difference from a web perspective. It's just going to be another way to interact with the application. And I think Scott's point of if that was the only way to do it, it would get pretty tiresome after a while.
Yeah, and I also think the iPhone has proven that we don't have to change the web to have mobile touch-based browsing actually work. So the iPhone today with Safari on the shows that it can be done using just the standard web pages we know. So
I've got a slightly different take. You talk about touch interface. I think we've in trouble by narrowing our view to touch. Because if you take things like Nintendo Wii, that's actually infrared, it's gestures, it's from away from the device. And if you look at things like TouchWall, which is a technology that was shown at the CEO conference by Bill Gates, it's putting the cameras on the screens that you're projecting to so that you can actually gesture, like you say, with the webcam away from the screen. And it's not about reaching forward and touching something physically, it's about natural interaction with the software or the technology that's in front of you. And I mean, there's some great examples of that with the infrared remotes. And I look at how we struggle in the transition. Like if you take a mouse, for example, very quickly we added zoom to the mouse and we attached that to the scroll wheel in the middle. And that was actually a bit of a, I want to say the word mind for people because the paradigm was not there. So I don't know, the early browsers, they took a concept of taking a piece of paper and bringing it towards you to make text bigger, which had scroll down, increasing the size of the text. And then we went with live maps, and it was about a camera, focusing away from you, changing the depth of field. And so scrolling up zoomed in and made the objects bigger.
And isn't it funny how things like control scroll make intuitive sense to techies, but not to our spouses?
Yeah.
Every time I show my wife control scroll, she's just like, wow, that's amazing. I'm totally going to remember that. And she never, ever uses that because it's not effortless.
So that's exactly it. As we bring these new paradigms into computing and the web and the way that we work, browsers changed. IE6 and Firefox 2 work the same way. IE7 came out, adopted to the mental model that was being discovered with the mapping and zooming tools. And Firefox 3 has now come over and followed that model. So you do see these changes happen, but it's just something that as you're evolving, it's like the clock ticking left and ticking right. There's only one reason why it goes clockwise, and it's because that one won out in the end.
So I mean, I'd love Trent to maybe talk a little bit about how, what makes an interaction modality inherently learnable? Why doesn't Scott's spouse know how to do click scroll?
I think part of it's consistency. So if you've got a consistent interface, that means that it's predictable, which means that it's easier to learn. And I think that's one thing that Microsoft's done pretty well in terms of the ubiquity of the kind of Office products, the way that we interact with the file, the view, all the kind of menus. And you're starting to see it now with lots of applications adopting the Office ribbon. So that's kind of interesting. So something that makes things inherently learnable, I think that you've got to make it so that it's easy to discover what's going on. So things like your... this is another example from Office. I'm not preaching. I am preaching to the converted here, but I'm not only a Microsoft guy. So you've got things like your print, right? You can print by going File Print. You can print by clicking on the little print icon. You can go Control P. You've got you can learn more and more sophisticated ways of interacting with the application. If you're brand new, you might go File Print all the time until you notice that Control P. So it's kind of making some of the functions discoverable is another really important thing.
Telling your spouse doesn't qualify as good discoverability.
I wouldn't say so. I, But I mean, I think this we get a little bit confused about this stuff, right? So when we talk about something being usable, we're actually talking about one of two things. We're either talking about ease of learning or efficiency of use. So there's times when ease of learning is good, right? If you're a kiosk and you want people to walk up and use it straight away, and that's the same for a lot of websites. But sometimes we're talking about call center applications where people are using this thing all day, every day. And we've done user testing where we haven't been able to keep up with the CSR. They're four screens ahead because the mainframe is rendering so slowly that they're actually, you know, stop, we can't keep up with what they're actually doing. So I think there's times when we talk about usability, we actually want to optimize for efficiency of use, not ease of learning.
So I think that a really good example of both discoverability and ease of use is the progression from Program Manager, which involved double-clicking, a non-discoverable activity. You can give a monkey a mouse, and they're never going to double-click. They'll click, and they'll click, and they'll click, but they'll never double-click. And there was nothing about Windows 3.1 that invited you to do something, to take action. Windows 95 introduced the Start menu. One click, big button marks Start. You have never seen a computer before. You figure out how a mouse works. Oh, I guess I'll click on this thing to start. And then Vista made going Start all programs, some programs, that much easier by just going Start and then start typing. I want a calculator, C-A-L, calculator. So that progression, I think, is a good
I'd like to see a confession of the number of people who, when they got the Office 2007 installed, didn't know that they could kick on that big round.
Because it doesn't say Start.
The little typing box at the bottom of Vista is my favorite Vista feature. Do I want to do anything? Windows key, start typing, hit enter. It's fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about privacy and privacy on the web.
Is it a very smooth segue?
I don't have to be smooth in any way.
I'm sorry, could you speak up? I can't hear you over that shirt.
Right, we are talking about privacy. You know, I'm going to keep your privacy sacred there, Scott.
I won't tell anyone where you bought that shirt.
So who thinks privacy is important? Who thinks privacy is not really that important? And what are the rest of you? You're just here for lunch. Right. So should I be worried about how much Google knows about me?
I'm much more concerned about how much my credit card companies know about me than Google. I mean, seriously, I worry about how much anybody knows about me, but my usage of Google, when I search or when I use Reader, I use Windows Live Mail, so I don't use Gmail, but those, I can see that. And in fact, one of the things that's interesting, if you look at the Google App Engine, is it's entirely tied into the Google authentication mechanism. So not only is it the applications that Google builds, but it's also the applications that get built on top of Google App Engine that they can, to some extent, track what you're doing. But it's also, the ubiquity of how I use, my charge card or my debit card and the places I go and the things that I buy, that's probably tells you a lot more about me than anything Google knows.
What do you think about the new IE8 privacy mode?
I don't know anything about it.
Do you want to explain?
Tell us about porn mode, Scott.
Thank you for saying that, so I didn't have to. IE8 has a new mode called
porn mode,
which you can turn on, which means that all of your tracks are not being kept locally. So cookies are not being stored, history is not being stored, and it's used for purchasing gifts for your family so that they don't discover that you were visiting Amazon.com.
I think it's also worth noting, though, that parental controls trump privacy mode. So, if you're using Vista, using parental controls, you're going to cover it. Also, in a corporate environment, the administration tools on top of IE trump privacy mode. It's just in some cases you say, it's false sense of security. In others, it is protection. My feeling on it, you look at other browsers, you look at ways that protocols are being designed for things like phishing. I never understood why a phishing protocol should contain information about the person who's asking. That for me is something that, I'm not convinced about.
I'd be interested to hear if anyone in the audience has ever used a formal privacy product like Anonymizer or Tor, Tor Park, or anything like that.
Anonymous proxy servers.
2, 3. Anonymous proxy servers. Come on, New Zealanders, raise your hand. Interesting.
Nobody wants to admit it in public.
No, but sometimes you just go searching for stuff and you just don't want anyone to know about it. If there's anything wrong with that. Yeah, geo-restricted sites, yeah. The NBC Olympics was, I had no idea as an American that everyone wasn't able to view this content. And, you know, you go to something.com and it's not unreasonable to assume that everyone gets to see that. Apparently it is, though.
Yeah, and another concern when we're on the topic of privacy is all these sites nowadays where you can, like Facebook, if you want to discover new friends, they ask you for your Gmail username and password. And they screen scrape Gmail to pull in all your contacts. And I'm not too afraid of Facebook screwing it up, but I think having users getting used to giving away their credentials directly on sites can be really scary over time as people get into this user pattern. Thankfully, there are kind of like standards like OAuth that enable sites to have data portability. And I think we really need to get those standards fake so people don't get
Let's talk more about credentials and security because
one quick thing I wanted to mention is that I did a podcast recently with a blind developer and he told me how he uses a screen reader to browse around on the web and I said, well, wouldn't it be great if your browser could announce that you were blind so I could give you a better experience? And he thought that was a great idea. We got all this feedback that said, well, that's a privacy issue. I don't want anyone to know that I'm blind. What if my insurance company sees me visit their website and then raises my insurance rates because they find out that I'm blind? Do I want my health records in my HTTP headers? He had no problem saying, yeah, I'm blind. Give me a better experience if you know that I'm blind.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between being blind and browsing with a screen reader.
I understand that. But you understand the general concept of what we were talking about. I mean, your browser announced what language you speak. Is that a privacy issue? Does anyone have a problem with that? Your browser announces where you live. He didn't seem that, if you could give me a better experience by me telling you one little bit of information about myself, wouldn't that be nice?
I think that's a really great point, and I think that people are lazy, and if you're going to end up giving away a little bit of data about yourself so that you can have a richer, better experience, then people are going to do that. So I don't know, but it's really interesting, that line. How much do you give?
So let's come back and talk a bit about what Jonas was talking about, and that's security. I mean, to me, security on the internet is just fundamentally useless. And that's how we see this preponderance of phishing attacks.
Well, it's broken.
It's right? Broken.
I mean, it was never. You've got to remember, the internet was designed in a trusted environment, right? I mean, it was designed inside of this environment where basically everybody who was connected to it was somebody that you could trust. And they were also, so there were no black hats, and everybody was also fairly technical, right? I don't think either of our spouses were online at that kind of time frame, right? And so, when you sit down and you lay out this entire model from the beginning. Security isn't something that you can sort of bolt on after the fact and ever get right. And that's basically what we're trying to do at this point. We as an industry is to bolt it on after the fact. And not surprisingly, it's patchy. You know, it's got problems.
It's really interesting to think about SSL versus EVSSL. Do you guys have that where the browser bar turns green? Because my wife always assumed that when the little lock goes locked, now I can trust them. But all that is it's privacy of the conversation, but I don't know who I'm talking to. I have no assurance, no trust. People assume HTTPS means trust rather than being secure. And EVSSL would be an example of bolting something on after the fact to make that work. EV means enhanced validation SSL. You get that green thing, and that indicates that you're talking to an actual organization that's been vetted.
Well, and just towards that, you mentioned OAuth a minute ago. The guys who do OAuth have written extensively about OAuth, open authentication, or open authorization, about basically getting a Karl Rove-style figure to go out and tell everybody how incredibly important it is. Karl Rove is a political...
Karl Rove is the mastermind that pushed Bush in power.
But we need somebody like him to go scare everybody so that they stop falling for phishing attacks. You know, if your authorization system is dependent on people learning how to spot a phishing attack, chances are there's a problem there.
So this is finally one where the infrastructure guy can pipe up. So like you, essentially on your point earlier on, so the fundamental protocols of the internet, like TCP/IP, was not designed with security in mind. It's actually in the RFC. And we're seeing a lot more of these kind of attacks on some of the core protocols of the web. So has anyone seen the attack recently about BGP? So to understand what BGP does, it controls the routing from site to site on the internet. And you can actually sort of attack that to control where traffic goes on the internet. And you can sort of intercept packets from the actual ISP level. So what ISPs have been sort of lagging in doing, and hosters in general, I spend all my time talking to these guys, so this is why I like talking about it, but they need to have some sort of protection or some sort of agreement that they only accept connections from various, from other parties that they actually know. They've been lagging behind the industry for about 10 years now with these protocols, so it's running on stuff that was designed in the 1980s, so it's really interesting when you see it from like the real low level to the high level. It's just it's quite messy down there.
But I mean, from a usability point of view, I've met plenty of people who don't use internet banking because they're scared about security. Is anybody doing anything to resolve that for those people?
Well, there's multiple layers. I mean, I worked in internet banking for 7 years. There's the user level where, you know, what I'm seeing in the browser, there's all the cross-site scripting issues, there's all the things that are happening on your desktop. But then there's your implicit trust that they're treating your information in a reasonable way. In the U.S., we have a thing called Fly Clear. So if you're a frequent traveler, you go in, you get your fingerprints and your retina scanned, and they give you a card, and it allows me to go around the security lines. So rather than standing in line, I do the thing, and they look at my retina, and I go through, and it saves me lots of time. Well, some Clear, and this is the name of the company, Clear, employee left their laptop on a desk in the San Francisco airport, and it disappeared. And in the 3 to 4 hours that it was gone, they freaked out. It had 30,000 people's information on it, da-da-da-da-da. And then huge amounts of damage has been done to the company's reputation. Then the laptop magically appeared in the same location. You know, and the guy says, well, we determined that no information was taken off the machine because no one logged in. Yeah, that's absolutely, you know, no one pulled the hard drive off. And so we'd have no way of knowing that. But they declared this in their kind of press release. And now 30,000 people are left to wonder, well, where's my information? They announced that we'll be encrypting information earlier in the process now. Turns out they only encrypt it after you've paid them and enrolled. So when you're in the pre-enrollment stage, your information is not encrypted. So, I mean, it makes you wonder for banks and companies that have your information in the U.S. when we give our social security number, which is tantamount to our immortal soul, when we give that to somebody, how often is that just typed into an Excel spreadsheet and saved on somebody's desktop?
So how do we ever know?
You don't. So you can move into a cabin in Montana and live there.
I think the other side of that is the kind of the user aspect. We did some user testing about 3 weeks ago with term deposits. So people were doing term deposits online, setting up new term deposit accounts. And this particular participant that we had about, at that time, around $700,000 worth of term deposits. And in her profile, what she'd done is she'd rung up the bank and said, I want my term deposits off my online banking profile. So she had all her, you know, normal current accounts in there, but not her term deposits. So she completely misunderstood the kind of the security of that. Like, there was no difference. There was absolutely nothing wrong with her having her term deposits online. It didn't matter. It was just in her head, the amount was such that she was like, I can't trust that to be even showing up online. And this particular bank has got a lot of online security kind of guarantees. So that's one of the recommendations we ended up giving them, is you need to educate the customers about these guarantees. They don't need to take off the term deposits from their online banking.
So let's talk a bit about, is banking the killer app for the web? Does the web have a killer app even?
I think it's collaboration. I work from home. I don't live in Seattle, and I don't work. I'm not going to move. But I've got, I have ubiquitous high-speed internet, sorry. But I was giving an example to a gentleman in the bar yesterday. He was asking me how I work remotely, and I work a lot with Rob Connery. Rob Connery's the guy that made Subsonic. He lives in Hawaii, and I've got four monitors. I've got two video cards and two monitors each. And every once in a while, Rob and I will just open up full-screen video, and I'll put him on one of my monitors, and we'll just sit there and we'll work in kind of silence like cube mates would. And then I'll just kind of go, hey, Rob, what are you, take a look at this. And it says there's like a portal into Hawaii. And I don't give that any thought. And with using things like Live Communicator and Skype, and I've been using a tool called Uvu, O-O-V-O-O, that lets me have up to 6 people simultaneously doing video from all over. And I work on a team that has 7 individuals, one of which lives in Redmond. Everyone else lives somewhere else. So I think the killer app is being able to just ring somebody up and have them come in full screen. Uvu just went from 320 by 240 to 640 by 480. It's like a DVD quality video. I mean, that's powerful.
Just to elaborate on what Scott's saying there, my feeling is that the evolution of the web is communication, and it's a fight between broadcasters, media companies, and telcos as to provide the next infrastructure for that communication. And if you think about it, you know, growing up at school, one of the things that amazed me the most was when we had a flatbed scanner come into one of the classrooms where I could put a photo down and get it in a digital form. And that...
You're showing your age now.
Yeah. Copy and paste now, you know, Control-C, Control-V, and that's getting photos on email. But we're still based on a textual web where we're doing that first phase. Soon we'll be communicating with the video end-to-end. We'll be expecting TV broadcast in HD via web channels. We'll expect to be able to, you know, manipulate and work 3D objects with each other. And also these other paradigms around the way the input-output, the way that we interact with our machines is also changing. So for me, the web is that evolution to communication, and it's a way to bring us forward with that.
I always like to point out when I talk to customers about Web 2.0 is that if you look at software on a computer is primarily around sort of increasing your performance, right, automation. The difference semantically between filling out a spreadsheet by hand and doing it in Excel, in the end, you have the same result. It's just one was dramatically faster and probably less error-prone. When you talk about the internet, it's all around making connections, right? And if you look at some of the very early, you know, generation Web 2.0 types of sites, I mean, things like MySpace. MySpace is all about how many friends do you have, right? You don't really do anything other than, you know, oh, I've got 8 bazillion friends on MySpace or something. But what becomes really fascinating is when you start to see these two concepts come together, right? Like, I mean, LinkedIn allows you to do things like, I can make these connections and then I can easily make, you know, questions of the people who I'm connected to, or I can easily push out changes to my contact information, so I can sort of get that combination of automation and connection in the same sort of space. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity in that space around automating how we do connections with other people. You know, I mean, how many, there was a website I saw at eTech a few years ago around just where are we going to go for dinner tonight? Right, you end up in, my wife will go out with her friends and they have this email thread that's 8,000 miles long because they can't figure out where they want to go. And there are sites that are around sort of having a discussion around that and being able to connect with, well, this is where you went last time and this is, you know, this is the hot spot in the area and you guys want to go see Sex in the City or what have you. You know, that's the kind of, you know, how do you start to automate these connections so that you're only getting involved in the high-level stuff and the low-level, you know, tracking kind of stuff falls by the wayside.
At some point, we're going to have too many cool sites.
Well, on the other hand, sometimes I don't want to catch up with the kids I went to elementary school with that are now in their mid-30s and fat and sad and on Facebook. There are people in my life I would like to just fade away.
Not prejudiced in the slightest, are we?
No, I'm just saying that I think it's funny how everything's about connections, and I'm starting to feel just a little too connected.
But to sort of carry on from your discussions around that where should we go and have dinner, at some point we're gonna verticalize a niche so tightly that just nobody's interested in it anymore. I mean, and the thing is, those sites are really dependent on there being a degree of network effect, i.e. they get value by there being lots of people who use them. And if they're too niched, if they're too restricted, if they're too targeted,
natural selection will take over.
Performing a certain task.
My buddy and I have decided that the best B2B Web 2.0 website we could come up with would be expiredfoods.com. It'd be an online marketplace for exchanging expired food. Just as niche as possible.
You can tell Scott's from Portland, right?
Why?
Do you want to explain to the audience how many bicycle riding, patchouli burning hippies there are in Portland?
Well, there's one less because I'm here, right?
Here's an interesting question for you. So if you could change one thing about the average web user, what would you change?
Go from IE6 to IE8 or Firefox 3. That's kind of the first thing that would make life a lot easier.
I'd have them turn on Windows Update.
Anyone else in the audience? What would you change? Come on, I'm looking for some... There's just sparse interactivity here, people. You'd make them use Firefox 3? Have you tried? So I'm a switcher backer. There's like the switcher, and then there's the switcher backer. So Silverlight, you'd make them install Silverlight, you'd change Silverlight. You want them to use Silverlight. Yeah? People who are keen on that? Why is that, sir? Because it's great? Fantastic. Bloody good. Anyone else? You know, what could we do to change users' behaviour?
Can I just pipe in here and say that's completely the wrong question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just to be a bit divisive. I think that's kind of a bit of an underlying attitude that we need to change ourselves and look at how can we build systems and websites so that they are more intuitive and easy to use for the users. And how can we make all the technology so that it helps people achieve their goals and we're kind of not having to explain that you need to click on a logo to go home. So I'd really challenge everyone in this room to think about it from the other point of view, is what can we do to make it easier and more intuitive for people.
A while back in an internal Microsoft conference, I forget which executive it was, but he was talking about how he'd been flying on this airplane and he happened to be sitting next to a woman who was reading a book about how to learn Excel. Right, like she was going to school and she had a textbook about how to learn Excel. And he was talking about the fact that that's the wrong mentality. Right, we in the software industry should be catering to the user, not the other way around. That's the reason when you asked, you know, what would you change about users? Nothing. Though I would like to see software updated and turned on. That is nice.
That's the thing, that human beings haven't changed fundamentally in a very long time, right? There's a lot of stuff that we know about how people work cognitively and all the rest, socially, our emotional kind of behavior. So it's technology that should be adapting to us, right? It's technology that's changing all the time. Us human beings fundamentally haven't really changed the way that we work. So.
I also think there's some cases where you have to break bad paradigms. A lot of organisations have been guilty coming in early and getting adoption for things that aren't fluent and you know, work well.
You got a question back there, Chris?
We've got a question at the back, guys. Fantastic. Have you had that up a while, sir? I've been derelict in my duty. Five or 10 minutes. Oh. Happy to take more questions from the floor, folks.
I think you're also missing another point, which sort of ties into both the usability issue and sort of, dear God, why won't these damn users just, you know, do what we ask them? Which is the technology providers, I think we also have a responsibility to educate the users and encourage them to understand what it is that we're trying to achieve or understand what it is we're trying to provide and really grasp the merits of what the benefits are to them to upgrading to IE8 or, you know, getting a better handle on what phishing is, that sort of stuff.
Is anyone doing that well? I mean, is anyone doing a good job of educating users? Is Microsoft doing it? Is Mozilla doing it?
I don't think users necessarily want to be educated, right? I mean, they just want to get their email. My 86-year-old uncle's computer died, and I couldn't get one with XP on it. I didn't particularly feel like buying one with Vista and paving it and putting XP on it, so I brought him a Vista machine and freaked him out. Somebody moved his cheese. You know, and I was like, you're on XP, right? You know, you're on a Dell Inspiron that I brought you in 1999. It's time to move on. And he's like, well, I don't want to move on. You know, I've got a good system here. You know, this is a guy who... When he receives an attachment, he couldn't discover how to right-click and hit Save As, but he could click the print button. So he'd print it out, he'd put it back in his scanner, and he'd push the one button on the scanner, and the button on the scanner would automatically save the file on his desktop.
Does he work for Dilbert's company?
But I mean, this is my uncle. I mean, this is how it worked. He found a way in two buttons. And to get a file saved in his desktop.
I think that was a really great point up the back. I think one of the problems that we're seeing, we do user testing across lots and lots of different industries and lots of clients, and one of the themes that come across is that people are sick of another username and password, and they're sick of sites trying to do something that, you know, they're not good at. Or, I mean, a good example, apologies if anyone from Yellow Pages who is a client of ours, so I should be careful what I say, and it's being videoed. So Yellow Pages has this idea where you can kind of log in and you save your frequently used Yellow Pages addresses here in New Zealand. I just don't get it. What, I mean, is that not what Outlook's for? If you're going to be looking up an address that often, you've already got tools to do this stuff. So MetService, you just focus on weather. Yellow Pages, you just focus on what you're good at. So I think that's what we're seeing, is that people are trying to get bigger and add in maps and add in all this other functionality that people don't necessarily want or need.
Got a question down the front?
Yeah, I think I remember it. Hang on. Yeah, with educating users and user experiences, of course you've got old legacy technologies which aren't necessarily very good at educating the user. It was kind of early days. But then you've got modern technologies where we can't have that as an excuse. I mean, we're not all going to have the uncles using old machines. But there was a good example in the talk yesterday about how in old Windows, when you're minimizing, say, a file, it would disappear and it would appear on the tab, but there was no relationship between what was happening there. And it was a good example about how in newer versions of Windows, there's that whole, the genie effect when it goes down. And that's kind of subtle, intuitive education for users.
I turn that off. Anyone else turn that off?
Yeah, well you understand your technologies, but the example was about a grandmother who just kept minimizing throughout the day and closing down and not realizing
she was
losing everything.
Yeah. And I think that's a good example of using animations properly. Look, people ask, why are animations such a big deal in Silverlight and WPF? And that's to make things that move or change more subtle, so you can see why things change it instead of just disappearing or appearing.
So yeah, that's subtle education that they don't necessarily have to opt into, but it's, yeah, how much of that is actually happening?
Not enough. So animation is a really good example, right, on the web. It's completely overused. So if you want to grab someone's attention, and we cannot help this is how we're wired, you can do one of three things. You can use saturated color, that's going to draw people's attention. You can use faces, we're hardwired to look at for people's faces, and you can use animation. That flickering draws us in. We cannot escape it. So what's that? It's a fear response, right? Fight or flight.
I read about this, that the reason that those ads with the people dancing, you know, I don't know if you guys have these ads here, we have these mortgage ads where it's like, you know, people dancing.
We don't have mortgage ads like you guys have in America.
All right, so if I go to CNN.com, I see basically a bunch of people dancing. Okay, it's animated, it's faces, and what was the other one?
Saturated color.
Color, yeah. And they're all turned up to like, and some of them are even just shadows of people dancing, like the iTunes ads. And they said it's because, and one of the reasons why television shows have such quick cuts is it's that flickering is the fear response, because when we were cavemen and we're saying, someone's sneaking into the cave? Oh, someone's sneaking into the cave.
Yeah, and that's actually about not holding the scene for more than 5 seconds. If you actually watch a TV program or an ad, they'll change angles every 5 seconds.
Yeah, so now that I've told you that, please don't use that for evil.
We've got a question somewhere down here. You forgot him?
So I just wanted to ask, with kind of the example of the iPhone, the format for the internet is moving away from the desktop PC into more and more devices. How do you see this changing the way people are going to design sites and use sites in the future, I guess?
I'm going to take a stab at this up front. It's interesting when you think about Flash and you think about full browser Flash sites, and then you think about HTML and traditional web, and this comes into the plugin conversation as well. I think there's some things that the new paradigm is going to open the door to, which will be completely different to everything before, which will require user training, which will be an explosive experience. Oh, sorry, won't require user training, but be an explosive experience beyond what you're used to. And it will work fluently, like a, you know, tab scroll, these sort of things. But I think also then, if that gets applied to everything else, it's just going to break, and we'll go through a period of adjustment where we go back to the way things are working already, and we look for these breakthrough experiences.
Yeah, and I think also if you have to redesign all your sites to fit on a mobile device, it's going to take too much effort for the mobile web to be big enough for someone to actually use it. So the successful mobile browsers are the ones like iPhone that takes any website and renders it in a decent way on a mobile. And also this morning, I think Opera just announced some really great sales of their Opera Mini, which is another mobile browser, which has a similar approach by taking any website, taking it to a proxy server, and then re-squishing the HTML and the images to make it fit on a mobile device. I don't think we can expect all website vendors to come up with mobile versions. So instead, the technology has to adopt to make it usable on the mobile device.
I've got a follow-up question for you, Trent. Is it on the iPhone, when I click on a page and it's formatted for the iPhone, the page will move to the left and the other one will come in because I read left to right and it makes sense. And I'm wondering how often these kind of intuitive usability techniques that are baked in at the human level work. Because left to right is an intuitive if you speak Arabic or Hebrew. I was having a hell of a time getting through the hallways here because all you fools are walking on the left. And I'm like, come on, pass on the right, pass on the right. How much of a problem is that, those paradigms that are at the human level and then at the cultural level baked in?
Yeah, so at the cultural level, we learn a lot, right? If you look at the actual design of web pages and the kind of the original, the way that it was built, or even Windows, right, to have the scroll bar on the right-hand side is not necessarily a great idea. Even blue-colored links, that's not the best color to be using to indicate a link. So what we kind of get is this... So if you're looking for contrast, the biggest contrast is black, yellow and black. Not that you'd want to do that, but...
Yes!
So Intigen's doing well today. Chris is doing well. So I think, to a certain extent, standards congeal without anyone really putting a lot of thought into necessarily whether it's a good idea that things scroll left to right and that sort of thing. So there's definitely some kind of human behaviours, and yeah, you're right, reading right to left to right will definitely change things around a little bit. But we also, having, you know, taking back what I said before, we also do tend to learn. The key is that there is a standard that we can kind of go from website to website to website and know that we can expect the scroll bars to work the same way, drop down lists to work the same way.
So how about you guys tell us about a web experience that's really knocked your socks off recently?
Halo synth inside of Photosynth? Yeah. I went out and just getting a person's face and photographing them all the way around in 360 degrees and then putting it in there and having a navigable 3D model is of that person's face. It's cool. Try it out.
Anyone else?
I had an experience that was not very visual, but it was using NevoSync, which is a tool that puts an exchange protocol on top of Gmail. And I was able to pull in all my Gmail and Gmail contacts without giving them my username and password. So in a secure way, I gave them access my information so that I can sync it to the iPhone. And being able to connect things like that was pretty powerful.
You mentioned the NBC Olympics site. I was very impressed with that, the design of that site. And there was some information that went around internally recently about the fact that the average user spent somewhere in the neighborhood of a half an hour on the site at a time. And if you know anything about studying web statistics and having somebody stay on your website for 30 minutes at a time is you measure that in epochs, right? I mean, it's just an enormous amount of time. You typically get, you measure that in, seconds, not minutes.
And
certainly not a half hour.
And that's worth good money, right? I mean, that's just straight. Any sneaky weasels get on the NBC Olympic site? Or a couple?
Yeah, one thing that knocked my socks off, I'm a video buff as well. We had the Democratic Conference over in the States. Is that right? Democratic?
DNC.
I've lost track of
Colorado, Mile High Stadium.
Yeah, but the video is delivered using Silverlight and Move networks, and the clarity in Australia and I guess New Zealand as well, it's phenomenal. It's like high definition video on a link that's like less than a minute.
Absolutely fascinating.
Unbelievable. So, and it's live, yeah.
So I was at home prepping my TechEd content, and I was watching, on the other monitor, full streaming high definition video over my Telstra Clear 10 megabit cable connection that you can't get in Auckland, but it was great.
One site that blew my socks off was, and this is unfortunately a US specific site, but it's called Hulu.com, Hulu.com. All of our TV stations have gotten together, and rather than having video on a TV station by TV station basis, they have it all at this Hulu.com site. and they've got, like, instead of having to go and buy a DVD of the entire season of Seinfeld or whatever, it's just, it's up there all the time. And the only thing that they do is they swap out fresh ads. So I can go and watch any show I want whenever I want. So I just started taking my laptop into the workout room, and I'll sit on the site for an hour, 2 hours, watching full screen, you know, 720p TV all over the web. It absolutely blew my mind.
So now everybody knows how to use these anonymous proxy servers, right? So we've got a question down the front here.
Not a question as much as just another comment on a new web technology, which is exciting. I don't know if anyone has installed Ubiquiti, which is a new Firefox plugin. And what it does is it sounds counterintuitive, but it provides you with a command line interface, which is actually very user-friendly in that you can define commands in JavaScript, which allow you... The idea ultimately is to provide a natural language interface for the browser. So you can type something like, book me 2 tickets to the My Bloody Valentine concert at the Santa Monica Civic Center tomorrow night, and, you know, email John. And, you know, that's essentially where it's going. But at the moment, it can do very basic things like translate web pages. It's really exciting.
So one of the things I'm liking, who's used Evernote? Anyone used Evernote? Evernote? All right, so Evernote is like OneNote, but it's all cloud-hosted. So I have Evernote on here that's got all the questions I've been asking. I have Evernote on my mobile phone, Evernote on my web browser, Evernote on all my PCs scattered to the ends of the earth. Fantastic experience.
One of the things that's interesting about Evernote, and I actually wanted to bring it up earlier when we were talking about different things that are going to change on the web, I think that we're going to start seeing a blurred line between text and what's going on in an image. With Evernote, I can take a picture of something, like take a picture of a piece of paper that had some information I wanted on it. Scott Cape is here from the U.S., and I wanted to borrow his wireless ID number, and I said, did you write that down? And he busts out his digital camera, and he took a picture of it. Turns out he takes pictures of everything that's interesting. If he gets a business card, take a picture of the business card. Evernote OCRs that. So then I can go and search it, and it'll put a little highlight over where it's found that text. So if I find a book that I want to read, I just bring out the iPhone, take a picture, yeah. It goes up to the cloud, OCRs it instantly, and I can search for it later.
So I'm saying if I'm in a meeting, we've done, you know, and I like whiteboards, done a big whiteboard drawing, take a photo of the whiteboard, and that gets dropped into my work or my home Evernote notebook. So that's well worth going and grabbing, www.evernote.com. I think it'd be quite cool to have a bit of a conversation about just maybe a sort of a quick cool tools conversation. But the gentleman down the front is keen to ask a question first.
I was just wondering what you guys think of, it's a different topic, sorry, but I was wondering what you guys think of net neutrality and traffic shaping and all those issues that are happening right now in the States that is bound to spill over to the rest of the world eventually.
Like the fact that your Comcast is now capped at 250 gigabytes per month.
I think, yeah, isn't it awful? Only 250 gigs? I don't know. I use that in a day. I think, not really, 2 days. I think that we will reject it. I think we can be afraid that it's going to happen, but I think ultimately the market will reject it. Now, 250 gigs is certainly a reasonable cap. They're trying to cut down on people doing illegal things and causing trouble. I think if they were capping it at 5 gigs, something like that, that would be oppressive.
Or 100 meg.
Or 100, 100 meg a day.
100 meg would be truly oppressive.
I know, I'm teasing. But the point I'm making is that if someone does something that is fundamentally oppressive, we will revolt. So I have confidence in our ability to revolt.
The internet is fundamentally designed to route around that sort of behavior.
But I think that people are fundamentally built to route around that kind of behavior. Yeah. So, I mean, the companies can do that, but they can kiss my...
Great, we're starting to get some good questions.
So, what happens when, you know, you get, like, a situation in New Zealand where there's actually not enough bandwidth? So the reason, you know, most people are on 10 gig plans is because we have, like, one or two links out of the country. What happens when, you know, you've got enough sort of high-definition video and that sort of content on the web that, you know, companies, if they're not investing, no longer have the bandwidth, and you have no choice but to go with one of these plans, like... How do you get around that? You can talk all about market forces and whatnot, but...
Yeah, and I mean, that is purely market forces. We do have capacity. There's a lot of dark fiber more coming online and some that's not in use right now. So it comes down to, I mean, if people want to do something, they will do it. Television New Zealand actually paired with Telecom and delivered a premium experience for the streaming of the Olympics here in New Zealand because it's always been possible. It's just a question of politics as to, you know, how big to open the pipe. So I do feel, you know...
Yeah, we have exactly the same issue happening in Australia in that we just don't have enough bandwidth to actually pull down. And internally, what we have one company do, you might have heard of Pipe Networks. I'm not sure if they've come across New Zealand. Pipe Networks have got peering arrangements with all the major telcos in the country, and it allows you to have high-speed transports between the major centres. It's all down to the regulation of the government, though. They're the ones that sort of are controlling that whole policy. So I guess similar to what you guys are happening, we had a new Prime Minister come in, and basically a lot of his IT vote pretty much came in on, we're going to improve the broadband infrastructure of Australia. And that went out to a very large telecommunications provider based in Australia, and they said, oh, we're not interested. Now that's gone up for tender. So we feel your pain, and the only way it's going to happen is by like freeing up communication between all these places and just allowing free peering. It's the best way for it.
So we've got a question in the middle here.
Yeah, just changing subject again to HTML, which is something that has been around since the web was a different sort of animal. Do you think that we will continue to fight a bit with HTML or that we need to move on to a different way of building these applications? Is something like Silverlight going to become the basic standard that we need to work with?
I mean, I think HTML, for all intents and purposes, is cast in concrete. Right, I mean, it's not going to change, and I think you're going to have that as the baseline experience, you know, for the foreseeable future. And I think that that's one of the reasons why, you know, products like Silverlight and that other one that starts with an F, what's it called again? I forgot. No, just kidding. Flash are getting so much interest from the people who design the web or people who build sites on the web because they want to have a better experience than this baseline HTML-based one.
I would add, though, that I think that Atom and Atom Pub and things like that, and also smarter browser plugins, like one that I really like right now is called PicLens. And you guys use PicLens? This is a...
Yeah, cool.
What do you guys call it? They changed their name? Since yesterday?
No.
Cool Iris?
Cool Iris.
That's a lame name. I'm going to call it PicLens. Apparently it's called Cool Iris, but basically the idea is that it looks at kind of the semantic web, looks at the page, sees that you've got a bunch of photos on the page, you hover over a photo, you get a play button, you click it, it goes full screen and makes a three-dimensional wall of photos, and it's a much more enjoyable way of viewing your Flickr photos, and it goes beyond that page. They have plugins that know this is a Flickr page, and I'm on page 1 of 30, so they'll go and progressively download thumbnails of the next 30 pages and allow you to literally Minority Report style float up and down this wall, and it works for Facebook and on and on and on and on and on. I think all of that is sitting on top of the semantic web. So HTML may be cast in stone, but how we view HTML is not.
Yeah, and I also think now with a lot of modern browsers like IE8 coming out, Firefox 3, Safari 3, we have a possibility to really build some great HTML, CSS, JavaScript standard-based sites. And I've always been a big fan of writing smart client applications because I've seen the web as a little bit too limited in what you can do in terms of user experiences. And whenever I think we reach the limit, there's some great jQuery UI widget that totally blows my mind of what you can do using standard-based design. And I think that over the next 2 years, I think JavaScript might be the biggest competitor to Silverlight and not Flash. Because the things you can do without having to depend on a plugin is pretty interesting.
Have we got tooling that really makes JavaScript pleasant yet?
Visual Studio 2008, Service Pack 1's got IntelliSense, you've got debugging. Just last week, John Rasig announced that they've got a nano jitter for JavaScript. They're talking about taking JavaScript to the speed of C now. So, I mean, JavaScript should not be ignored.
So you guys need to go and download 2008 Service Pack 1.
There's also technologies like Volta, which are, if you haven't seen it, this is a project out of Windows Microsoft Live Labs, where you write your code in C#, and then they basically parse in the compiled IL and write out JavaScript. So those kind of because in the end, basically JavaScript is IL for your browser, right? I mean, this is, for all intents and purposes, you know, assembly language. And nobody likes writing in assembly language on the desktop, so I think the same thing could be also said for JavaScript, that it's pretty low level, and I'd really rather be writing in something higher level than that. But the tools are coming online. I think Google has is a web toolkit that allows you to do the same kind of thing with Java. There's some tools in the Rails community that allow you to do Ruby to JavaScript, ScriptSharp. Yeah, so there's all kinds of these tools that are allowing you to write in these other higher level languages and then translate it down to JavaScript on the bottom side. And that, I think, becomes a much more interesting down the road approach than having to write in JavaScript directly.
It is worth pointing out that while there are people on one side trying to take high level languages and use JavaScript as IL, on the other side, there are people going bottom up on JavaScript and trying to turn that into a fully fledged object oriented dynamic language. So I think there may be kind of a race to the middle.
Both ways feel like a complete bastardization to me. I mean, you know, we should. Why are we not? And with Silverlight, we are. So with Silverlight, you can.
But seriously, don't underestimate JavaScript. There's a thing in Java that was around for years called processing. It was a language that you would write for visualization. So it's a custom domain specific language that did visualizations. And it would do visualizations of whatever. You could do three-dimensional things, two-dimensional, whatever. And it was entirely designed to make these kind of physics simulations incredibly easy, but it was built on Java. John Rasig and the jQuery guy, the guy who made jQuery, ported this from Java, a virtual machine language we've known for years, to JavaScript. So he can run the same processing is the name of the language, processing scripts in JavaScript now. So now you have a situation where the rise of JavaScript has come to the point where it literally is competing with a Java VM, which was state-of-the-art 10 years ago.
I forget the name of the project, but at Langnet this past year, we saw, if you're at all familiar with Squeak, right? So Squeak is this small talk-based environment where you can do all kinds of interesting experimentation. This was a Squeak type of application that ran in the browser on JavaScript. Right, the same kind of fully rich, interact with anything on the page, change it, manipulate it because it's all dynamic, but it all was running in JavaScript. It's a language that's very strange, I think, for most object-oriented programmers, right? The whole prototype-based object methodology seems sort of foreign, and I think that that's one of the things that really sort of hangs it up. I think for intents and purposes, I mean, you see the arguments that have gone around with the bottom up trying to make JavaScript a better language. I think those, for all intents and purposes, it's cast in stone too, right? I don't think you're going to see the kind of dramatic improvement to the JavaScript language that some people want to see because not everybody's on the same page on this, and we're not going to be able to bring it forward in that way any more than we can bring, you know, extensive changes to the HTML. Well, yeah, but it's going to get faster, but it's going to still be the same language.
So Scott mentioned the semantic web just a couple of minutes ago. Who's keen to have a bit of a talk about whether the semantic web has ever really delivered on the vision that it proposed in the late 90s?
Yeah. Well, microformance is one example of trying to use more of the semantic webs to pull up information. Things like RSS feeds, it's one example, Atom, iCal, vCard, yeah. Yeah, Scott got heaps of examples.
Was that ex-girlfriend's network?
If you go to Phil Hack's blog, whenever he mentions somebody, there's this little icon next to it. And if you hover over it, it says, you know, hey, I talked to Scott Hanselman yesterday. And you'll hover over it, and it'll say, friend, met, man crush, or whatever. Micro formats are a way to tunnel semantics, standardized semantics, in CSS and HTML, and if you have XHTML in namespaces, such that you could mark something up. So rather than saying, meet me on Tuesday at 5, and then having to write some funky program that knows how to parse out what Tuesday at 5 really means as a date, you would put in a little snippet of this micro format. It's not a format for an entire document, it's a format for a snippet. And then you'd put the actual date there. So you could say not only that Scott Hanselman is a name, but he's my friend, and this is how we interact. If you say I want to have a, you could take that date, say this is a date, but you could expand that into a calendar so that you could hover over it and launch your calendar application with things like iCal.
And a lot of the UI frameworks as well built on JavaScript, like the jQuery UI components, are based on semantic in HTML. So you might have something like PicLens or something that pops up and gives you a better image viewing experience if you mark up your HTML correctly. Like you add a rel, that might be the category, you add some extra text using the capabilities of HTML, and then adding another layer of behaviors on top of it using JavaScript to give you a better image viewing experience. And I think perhaps a lot of .NET developers have forgotten how to do those kind of things after living in a web forms world for a long time, where you drop in a ASP.NET menu tag, and at runtime you have 200 lines of HTML. And if you're used to living in that kind of world, it's hard to take advantage of some of the semantics of the web.
Just really quickly, so we're talking about micro formats and HATOM a little bit there. An extension of that is the web slice capability inside of Internet Explorer 8. So it's using a micro format process. Sorry, it's using a micro format process to mark up the that as a web slice, so that you can actually keep that content in your favorites bar in the browser.
Well, I think the thing that's also fascinating about micro formats is, again, that HTML is for all intents and purposes in concrete, and yet that doesn't mean that you've stopped the innovation, right? You can still build interesting things, interesting new things that don't require changing the underlying HTML format, right? And micro formats blew my mind when I first understood what they were doing, because they're saying, oh, look, we're going to use these CSS, styles, which are typically being used for, graphical styling, right? This needs to be underlined in blue or whatever. I hear blue is not a good link color, but whatever.
Yellow.
Yeah, okay, so it's underlined in yellow, you're right. But now I can actually tag this little piece of information as being, a location or a person or something like that, and use that same exact capability for a reason that was totally different from how it was originally created. Semantic information instead of graphical styling information. And this is sort of the same thing with JavaScript as IL, the idea that it's an assembly language and people are building on top of it. You lay down the platform and then you innovate on top of it. And I think there's some really fascinating things happening in that space.
I think also the idea of using an HTML web page as a jumping off point for alternative formats by tunneling things in the meta tags, it has a room for abuse. But if you go to a website, go to my blog and view source, and you can see that I've got meta tags that say things like, if you're on an iPhone, here's the icon that I'd like you to use for your home screen. It's just a single line of HTML. If you go to anyone's blog, you'll see that the single line of a meta tag that says, here's the alternative format for my RSS, which then causes the browser to light up. I recently added Open Search. Open Search is a new format. It's an XML format that allows you to get into that search bar in your browser. So if you show up to my site, you'll see that little search chevron kind of flash in the corner of your system. You pull it down, it'll say, add Scott's Computer Zen as a searchable site. It adds that search provider to either Firefox or IE. It's a totally new format integrated with HTML by virtue of that meta tag. And it teaches the browser how to search my site or how to search Amazon. IE8 has extended that concept and allows now autocomplete and preview searches. So if you start typing on Amazon, it'll show you previews of what it thinks you might be looking for, as well as images of the things that you're looking for. These are all examples of taking tiny little formats, not complicated XML, and getting a much better experience while keeping HTML in concrete.
It's actually interesting. If you look at a lot of the work that's been done over the course of the last couple of browser iterations, most of that work is in the Chrome. And then in the Chrome, around the browser, right? Not the actual format of the browser itself. I mean, I remember, I think it was actually Firefox 2, that if you looked at the long list of things that Firefox 2 was adding, the only thing on the entire list that had anything to do with rendering the web page, other than like bug fixes and performance improvements, was spell checking. Right, that was it. Everything else they were doing was in the Chrome. And I think that you take the idea of tunneling small micro formats, like the open search, like here's where my RSS feed is, here's my icon for iPhone, and combine that with the Chrome of the application, there's tons of innovation that can be occurred there that don't require actually changing the underlying HTML format at all.
So we've got another question through here.
Can you talk a little bit about Flash and Silverlight in relation to search engines, about where we are now and where you see the future going with search and those kind of technologies?
Well, Flash recently announced that they were going to work together with Google and Yahoo to make Flash content more searchable. But there's no reason why search providers couldn't index Silverlight content. So even though in Silverlight 2 your content is packaged up to XCP file, it's just a zip archive that the search provider could pull down, unzip it, and try to sniff out what information you have inside it.
Another option is to have, if you have like a Silverlight experience on top, you could provide an HTML that's not visible to the user, but it's visible to the search spider trying to index your website, so that way you can give some searchability of your site.
Like, also, an alt tag, right? The Silverlight equivalent of an alt tag.
Yeah, like a big alt tag. Like,
this is what happens when you search images on Google, right? They're using the context around the image and that alt tag to find out if they've got the right image.
Yeah, exactly. And you could have, like, if you had show all your content, you could just updating the content in the background to show the HTML. But that being said, searching Silverlight and Flash is often a little bit of a different beast than searching HTML, because HTML is often used for content, but for Silverlight apps, it's more apps. So how do you kind of get the endpoint to that experience after clicking four clicks, filtering out information? How is
The key is to keep the data that's consumed by those things in a format. I think that people, in my opinion, people overblown this whole kind of, Silverlight's closed format and you can't search it, blah, blah, blah. Well, insert Flash in that sentence and say it again, right? These are examples of applications. If you are producing content that is consumable only by Silverlight or only by Flash, it should also be available in some format that can be parsed. Google's been indexing PDFs for a long time. If they can index that, they can index anything.
Yes, I think something we might see evolving is things like microformats, having sitemaps that gives you endpoints into your Silverlight application. So whenever they find some data that can be viewed by this Silverlight application, Google would know, like, I need to create this link when we click this information to give them the Silverlight experience instead of the XML data Google might have indexed or Windows Live Search.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, there's a thing in Silverlight called the JavaScript bridge, and it's a two-way bridge as well. So you can call out into the browser's DOM, and you can do things like make sure that when you change context inside of Silverlight, you're also providing updates inside of the address bar in the browser so that you can always link back into the right point of your content. And this is more around search engine optimization, but I think there's a session at Mix on search engine optimization and Silverlight that talks through some of these techniques as well.
And so you can pull that down, www.visitmix.com. You can watch all of the videos from Mixo 6, Mixo 7, Mixo 8. Hey, we're actually coming to the end of our time now, team. I know you're all going to be pretty eager to be among the first to get to lunch. Is it lunch? We've got one more session. Oh, man, I'm not going to be able to survive till lunch.
I'm going to Subway.
You're going to Subway? We'll go to Subway. If anyone wants to join Scott and I at Subway, just let us know. Hey, so thank you all for coming along. It's been a fantastic session. Great to get such a huge audience to a round table like this. Hope you all have a fantastic time at TechEd and look forward to seeing you all in a slightly more inebriated state this evening. Thank you very much.